Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. This is, by all accounts, this should be a good show. I think it's up to us, but I think it's going to be a good one.
Well, you've set it up now.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. Later on, we're going to talk to David Sanger of the New York Times. We're going to talk about, obviously, he's the national security correspondent. And then we're going to talk to two incredible people, one Danny Goodwin and Edward Schwarzschild, who are at SUNY Albany. And they have done this project about the world being under surveillance. And they've done a book. Ed has written the text. Danny has taken these photos, and it bears witness to people tasked with safeguarding our modern world, and it's just fascinating. So we'll be talking to them as well. So a lot going on. Let me introduce our incredible panel to you. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. You're the really incredible part. Panel at WAMC.org. We welcome partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hannah, Sienna Freeman Tolbert. Good morning, Sienna. How are you?
Happy to be here.
It's good to have you here.
Yeah, I'm excited. I was up late.
Yeah. That's the fun part of national conventions from Chicago. Then we welcome Judy Patrick back to the program, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. We welcome Kristen Van Genhoven, theater artist, arts advocate, activist, and executive director for Project Sage in Lakeville, Connecticut. Hello, Kristen.
Hello. I also was up late, but here we are, and it's great to be here, and it does seem to be like it's going to be a really awesome show.
Now, what's interesting is that when we say we were up late, we turned off the television and then went to bed. Our next guest, Kathy Sheehan, mayor of the city of Albany, was in the hall in Chicago dancing her feet off and then has to get back to the hotel. What time did you finally get to bed, Kathy?
Well, you know, it was today.
Well, there you go. Kathy Sheehan, mayor of Albany, at the Democratic National Convention, calling us from Chicago. We couldn't be more thrilled to have you on the phone with us. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. So generally, how are things going?
Oh, I mean, it is just so exciting here. The enthusiasm. It's just an amazing thing to see. People coming together. You know, I was at the convention in 2016, and, you know, there were still the Bernie folks, and it was great. It was wonderful. But this is just, it's hard to describe, but because there's just such unity in the room and on that floor. And it's just been really fun. I think the most thrilling thing for me is that I actually got an I'm jelly text from my son yesterday, because Little John came out. I don't know if you all got to that.
Yes.
We were doing the roll call. And so to have my 24-year-old jealous of me at a convention, it was kind of cool. And we all conceded that, you know, Georgia won in the roll call.
Yeah.
Who could top that?
That's right. Georgia certainly won during the roll call. It's an amazing sense. I mean, from watching it on television, both during the primetime coverage and just throughout the day, it seems as though this is well, you can't, not that you try, but you can't kick the smile off these people's faces. It is everyone just seems to be joyous. And I don't know how you try to, I don't know how you then say to that, okay, I mean, the big question that all the media is having is, well, how do you keep up this momentum? And I guess that's a fair question, Kathy.
Well, I mean, From the people that I'm speaking to from all over the country, they have been seeing incredible turnout when they're doing door-to-door calls with volunteers. I'm a surrogate for the campaign, and I kicked off a phone bank that was happening, people from the West Coast calling in to New Hampshire, calling in to Wisconsin. And people are turning out to volunteer in record numbers. So there's a tremendous amount of enthusiasm. And it's in that hall, right? We're all delegates and Democrats who are here for the convention, so you would expect it. But what is happening across the country at our hotel, we have Wisconsin in the House, Oklahoma in the House, Maryland. They're seeing that same level of enthusiasm at the ground level, when whether it's a call for canvassing, a call for phone banking, a call for writing letters and postcards. So, you know, we're seeing it, and it's really the diversity of age range as well. You know, young people really fired up and getting involved. So we do have to, this is going to be a tough election. This is going to be, it's going to be close. We've got to fight for every vote. But I think what you're hearing is that we're really speaking to all Americans at this convention. And that's the other piece of this that I hope is coming through with respect to the television coverage of that, is that this isn't just about Democrats. It's about all Americans, and it's about our future. And I think that we have a message that resonating really across the political spectrum.
Hey, Kathy, it's Judy Patrick. I have two questions. First, are all those Wisconsin people wearing the cheese hats?
Yeah.
They are.
I was wondering about those.
I was asked about that. I mean, I think that New York needs to really step it up 4 years from now, because not only did we not have somebody rapping when we did the roll call, but we do not have a hat game going at all.
I think I respect the state of New York for not having a hat game, but I don't know. That's just me.
Maybe folks can write in, what would the New York hat be?
Well, you know, it's going to be like the Statue of Liberty crowd or something.
That's exactly
I don't know.
I thought.
All right, second question. So Oprah was the big surprise guest last night. Let's make some news here. Who's tonight's big surprise guest?
So, you know, they don't tell us. It was a surprise to us. She was not on the list, didn't know that she was going to be there. So, I can't wait to see who it's going to be. But, you know, it was really wonderful to all of the speakers. I thought Hakeem Jeffries, you're probably going to get to this, Joe. He was great. I was actually with a group of mayors from across the country when he was speaking, and I mean, they were blown away, and that was a really fun moment in this convention. So I'm waiting and anticipating along with you.
Well, the big news last night, of course, was Tim Walz and accepting the nomination and speaking. And here is a guy who a few weeks ago, most people in America probably were not aware of him. And then he's on one of the biggest stages in all the nation and in the world, and talking about, I would say, a very modest background of not even talking about his political career, but talking very much about his career prior to that. What is the mood in the room regarding him, regarding the choice, and the feeling of the message that he conveyed on that Chicago stage last night?
Well, he felt a ton of love last night. Everybody was on their feet, couldn't wait for him to come out. When the football team came out, that was just a brilliant moment. Kudos to whoever came up with that idea. And I think that in addition to him just being a really sincere, relatable person, somebody with a background that I think will be very beneficial in the White House, because he can relate to average Americans. I think what I heard people talking about was what a brilliant choice it was and how it reflects on Kamala Harris's leadership. Because, as you said, most people had never heard of him, didn't know who he was, didn't know anything about his background. She had a lot of pressure. She had 2 weeks to pick a vice presidential candidate, a running mate, in what is going to be a very close race where everything was changing all at once. And I listened to him last night. I looked at what he brought to that stage, what he brings to that ticket, and I thought, Kamala Harris is ready for this, because the choices that you make reflect your leadership ability, and I think that this is a choice that demonstrated exactly who Kamala Harris is and who she'll be as president of the United States.
He tweeted last night, it's the fourth quarter, we're down a field goal, but we're on offense. We're driving down the field, and boy, do we have the right team to win this. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so. I think for all the enthusiasm here, nobody is taking their foot off the accelerator. This is going to be a close race, and we have to continue to get the message out there that we've been talking about, you know, these past 3 days, and that we'll talk about again today, about the future of this country and the direction that we're going in and why it's so important that we continue on the path that we're on and not go backwards. And there are a lot of people's rights that are on the line. We heard about the reproductive freedoms. We've heard about the kitchen table issues that people are dealing with, but we recognize that we're not ahead in this. We've got to continue to work for every vote.
We're all hanging on every word you say here, Kathy, because it's so exciting to have you calling in from actually being there, because we're all smiling and nodding, and it's just awesome to kind of hear your boots on the ground perspective of it. Everything you say this fourth quarter and what he said last night, this is where I think the short time frame is really beneficial. Because holding this momentum for, as Governor Westmore said, right, 75 days and one wake up is a lot easier than when you're doing it and you still have like 18 months in a campaign. We all know that it's going to be up and down. And I've really appreciated two things that they've been doing during the DNC. And it sounds like that message has really been put into action by everyone that's there of like, we got to go up and down the ticket. Like, we have to get the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, and also, like, don't take this for granted. Like, don't take this momentum for granted. Like, we really have to keep our head down and move that forward. And from what you're saying, Mayor, it sounds like everyone's really taken that to heart and already, like, putting that into action. Like, you're already making calls and stuff right from there.
Yeah, there's work happening here with respect to, again, continuing to campaign and phone bank. You know, it's funny. Somebody said to me, you know, I haven't seen anybody from the campaign. And I said, yeah, because they're out campaigning, right? The campaign staff, most of them, I've seen a few folks here, but most of them are nose to the grindstone, working it and making sure that those field offices are doing all that they can do to get volunteers to turn out. And so everyone's working.
I have a question. Like, they've done such a great job of making this vice presidential candidate, you know, the nominee, Tim Walz, this everyday, relatable guy, you know, who's done these amazing things that, of course, the Democratic Party fully endorses in the state that he governs. I'm curious about how the flip side of that and his, like, awareness of foreign issues, foreign security, relationships with leaders of other countries, you know, is that something that you think Kamala Harris is going to address tonight? Because we all, you know, I sit here and I go, okay, well, how's he going to do, you know, with all of those responsibilities that come with people in the White House? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, again, I think it's about putting people around you who are experts with respect to those types of subject matters. And again, I think that Kamala Harris's choice of Walz as a vice presidential candidate, as her running mate, demonstrates that she's very good at taking in a lot of information and then finding the right person, right? And so, you know, all of these issues, you know, whether it's Ukraine, Israel, these are all very serious top-of-mind issues. And they're not going to wait for an election. They're happening in real time. And I think we have Vice President Harris who knows these issues and has been working on them alongside the president. And we have in Tim Walz somebody who's just so authentic. He's just an authentic person who has demonstrated that he can learn new things. He can adapt. He is going to put everything into the job. And I don't think there's anything he can't learn and can't come up to speed on. And so I think we've got a great team. And these international issues are very serious. And we've got, you know, a great You know, when you look at the team that President Biden has assembled, I think we've got an A team working on it, and there's going to be an A team that continues to work on those issues.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan is with us. We also have Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Judy Patrick, and Kristen Van Genhoven. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. The mayor will be with us till 10 o'clock this morning. We'll be back right after this break. The amazing Darlene Love will be performing along with Natasha Bedingfield for a very special benefit event for Berkshire Theater Group and Barrington Stage Company at the Colonial in Pittsfield on Thursday, August 29th, so 1 week from tonight. And we'll be playing music from both Darlene Love and Natasha Bedingfield in coming back into our breaks this morning during the panel. To learn more, you can go to barringtonstageco.org or berkshiretheatergroup.org. But it's never a bad morning when you get to hear Darlene Love. Sienna.
I was going to say, hi, Mayor. I'm also jelly, like your son, that I wasn't there to see little John. I'm very, very jelly. I have downloaded the Spotify playlist of all the roll call songs, and it is excellent, by the way. But, you know, we knew one of the main goals of this, you know, DNC was to introduce the vice president and Tim Walz to the country. And they've done an excellent job of that. But what I continue to hear over and over again is about the lack of specific policies being mentioned at the DNC. And so I know last night during Tim Walz's speech, he gave a little snippet, so to speak, of what the policies were and what you could go talk to your undecided voters about, which I thought was an excellent moment. But what are you hearing about the policies? I'm hearing that the vice president is supposed to speak in more specific terms tonight, but I'm not sure. So what are you hearing about that?
Well, look, I think that, you know, the platform is available for anybody to look at. And, you know, typically the convention is more about speaking to people's hearts, speaking to the values that the party holds, and having people really get to know those who are leaders in this party. Certainly the president and vice presidential candidates, but we've heard from a number of outstanding leaders. And all you need to do is look at what they're doing. You know, Wes Moore. You know, the Hakeem Jeffries, and look at what they're fighting for. And so, you know, I think when you get down to the specifics, you know, Vice President Harris has talked about wanting to invest in home ownership. And we know what that looks like. We know how to do home ownership assistance. We do it now. We get funding from HUD, and we're able to help people with down payment assistance so that they can get into that first home. She wants to take that program and grow it and expand it and recognize that when you give people the opportunity to start to build generational wealth, you grow the economy because people are able to put their children through college, start a new small business, and have that American dream. And so that's a policy that we've been talking about. We've been talking about continuing to drive down the price of prescription drugs. That's a very important pocketbook issue for the average American. And, you know, there's a stark contrast, right? You have a presidential candidate who, when he was president, tried to get rid of the, Obamacare, and would do the same. You know, they want to roll back benefits, and we're talking about how do we ensure that the average American can make ends meet and not worry that they're going to lose their home because of a medical bill. So these are areas where there's stark contrast between the policies of what a Harris administration would look like and the policies of the former president, seeking to become president. And so I hear the media saying that, and I think those are Republican talking points, because I feel like we are talking about these policy issues. We talk about them all the time.
All right. So let me morph
Sienna's excellent question with your excellent answer together for me to ask this question. So if all the information is up there and it's the platform and it's available, for you as a mayor of the city of Albany, is there something missing? Is there something that we are not talking about that we should be talking about that gives you concern?
Well, no. I mean, I think we are talking about, let's talk about, you know, a huge policy issue, right? Reproductive freedom, which you know, is really about our autonomy as individuals. So we're talking about reproductive freedom, but we're also talking about gay rights, gay marriage, and a whole host of issues that I think are really important to people. And there is another stark contrast between the policies of the other party and the other candidate and what a Harris administration would seek to ensure for those of us who this is a really important issue. I think we are talking about very real issues. I was at a panel discussion with Governor Whitmer yesterday afternoon, or I think it was 2 days ago. It's you lose track of time here.
Yes.
Where we talked about reproductive freedom alongside gun safety, right? Because these issues, while you wouldn't necessarily think of them as going together, they do go together. How do we keep people safe? And how do we prevent mass shootings and mass loss of life? So that's another issue that Democrats are talking about. We want common sense gun laws that keep us safe. And that is, again, a stark contrast between what the Democrats would continue to do and bring to the White House and what the other party would. So I can't think of an issue that really matters to our, the average American and to our cities that we aren't talking about. And I've said this over and over again. I was mayor under the other guy. And I have to tell you. I'm dead serious.
No,
it was scary times. It was scary times. You know, we didn't have access to, the information that we needed and the help that we needed, especially during the pandemic. We were ready to lay off hundreds of city employees, firefighters, police officers, because we have to balance our budget. And he said, too bad. I'm not sending you aid. I'm not going to help. So, that was the answer that we got under the other guy. So, yeah, as a mayor, the issues that the Democrats are talking about and the relationship and the partnership that we will have is something that's going to be really important for not just the residents of the city of Albany, but the entire region and the entire country.
We'll have a much better sense of this in just a few months. But 74 days to Election Day, and you look at it of where we were a month and four days ago, I believe. And this is starkly different than that. And I'm just wondering, in your opinion, has that actually been in some way helpful? That it has distilled everything and has focused everyone really quickly to a point where that this excitement that we're seeing, the motivation that we're seeing, the trouble that the Trump campaign has in coming up with a message, that all of this is caused by this fact that we have taken an election that we thought we knew exactly what was going to happen for 2.5 years, and all of a sudden, 90 days before, it all changes.
I mean, I'd really be interested in hearing what the other panelists think of that. I mean, for me, I've known President Biden for many years. I've watched his career. I've had the opportunity to speak with him and to meet with him on a number of occasions. And I think it speaks to his ability to see that there needed to be a change and that this was what was best for the country. But, to me, I'd love to hear what others think of that.
I'll say that I think it's exactly how you put it for most part, Joe. I think that there is this electric energy around it once this decision was made and we all kind of coalesced around Vice President Harris to push her over the push her over, you know, to win the election because we know what the alternative is. However, as someone that practices in something such as immigration, Mayor, you know, that's a big issue over the last year with us, especially when it comes to the Biden campaign, Biden administration. We had some rough times, I would say. And so I think that there's, you can do that. You can push Vice President Kamala Harris and say, go, you can do this. Also hold her accountable. What are you going to do about immigration? What are you going to do about border security? We have not seen much. You know, we've seen some new policies. I'm going to applaud them coming down from the executive branch for immigration. But we're still waiting and we're still looking for those concrete solutions that we know maybe only Congress could do. But we still want to hear that. And so I think you can still hold the Biden administration accountable and Vice President Harris accountable for these issues such as immigration, and at the same time coalesce around her and understand that this is still the, you know, the greater good, and this is the best answer and the optimal candidate for this election.
Doesn't take this long in Canada, does it, Kristen?
Oh, no. That actually, it takes this long. It takes, like, since it actually does take exactly this long, right? Of, like, when it switched to coalescing around her, and we're seeing how that can work. No, it's 6 weeks, right? I would have to fact check that to be absolutely sure, but you call an election 6 weeks later, people go out and vote. There's a cap to how much people can donate towards it. There's all kinds of rules about it. It's so different. But I was thinking about how good we have all become at pivoting, right? We learned so much about this election is really coalescing all of the things over the past, like since 2016, right? We have a chance at redemption, especially white women, right? We were such a huge reason why 2016 ended up going the way that it did. We have this chance at redemption. All of these things have happened over the last 8 years, 12 years that have like given us lessons learned and ways to like have an opportunity to right the ship. We've learned how to pivot. We've learned why we need to be on the right side of history. We've learned how we are accountable to the decisions that we make. We've seen the consequences of checking the box we shouldn't have checked. And this is a chance. I think we're feeling this energy of like, all right, we have a chance to make this right. We have another shot at doing this. At the same time, I think people, you know, there was global PTSD on November 7th, 2016, and we're nervous, right? We're scared that we're going to feel that again. And those were like, there's been a lot of therapy sessions that people are still having processing all of that. So we want to feel super hopeful. We want to believe we can make this happen. We're hearing this over the past 3 days in these extraordinary speeches from Oprah and Michelle Obama and Hillary Clinton and, you know, being like, we can do this. But also we're like, I also want to protect my mental health, right? Because this was such a challenging time. But I'm, you know, Michelle Obama turned me around. I'm like, all right, I'm getting the bumper sticker. I'm writing the postcards. I'm making the phone calls. Let's just do
it. But with all this optimism, Judy, I mean, the polls still tell us this is an extremely close race, especially, I think, 2 points, a statistical dead heat in general. And in some of the swing states, especially Georgia, there's a 4 or 5 point difference with Trump leading. So this is still an extremely close race, even with the incredible momentum we've been seeing.
Indeed it is. And in fact, I think those were important messages we heard, particularly from Hillary Clinton and from former President Clinton, who made the point that, you know, don't give up. There's a lot of work to be done. Don't take this for granted. I think the compressed timeline of this campaign has added the spontaneity that you don't normally get in a political campaign, because political stump speeches typically are, you know, researched and tested and retested, and as a result, they become stilted. But I'm curious. So, Kathy, you're a surrogate for the campaign. New York seems to be locked up for the Democrats, it traditionally is. Does that mean you're going to go to battleground states?
Yes. So I've gone to New Hampshire, and the virtual surrogate work that I've done has been in other states. And so I could get a text today asking me to go to Wisconsin in 2 days. You know, I'm going to, as much as my schedule as mayor, which is pretty full, will allow, I am going to be doing as much of this work as I can, because it is about, again, bringing home very real examples of what the difference is and what the contrast is. And you know, picking up on the immigration, you know, that's another issue that I didn't talk about. But, you know, this Democratic ticket would have supported the immigration package, the bipartisan immigration package that Trump killed for political reasons, right? Because he doesn't, you know, it's not about the humans behind these policies. It's about scoring political points. And that's just reprehensible. But, you know, I think if you want to know what a President Harris would do about immigration, you have to look at the bipartisan immigration package, which was not perfect, but which was a start. And that tells you, you know, the direction that the Democrats want to go. And hopefully we'll get a majority in the Senate and in the House so that we can get these real reforms and real changes pushed through. And again, that was a bipartisan package that was worked on by Republicans and supported by Republicans until at the last minute Trump stepped in and killed it.
That seems, I was reading an article last night that the water cooler talk at the convention is, sure, we're going to be hearing from the vice president tonight and accepting the nomination officially, but the big chatter is about the future of the House and Senate.
Yes, and I think that watching Hakeem Jeffries last night, again, I was, you know, standing with a group of mayors from all over the country, and, you know, I said, okay, he just made the case for why we need to make him Speaker of the House, because, I mean, he just, to me, brought such an energy, and, you know, it's hard for me to gauge how that is landing in American living rooms, but, you know, to be there, it was really energetic, and I think, again, demonstrated the type of leadership that I think we should have in the House of Representatives.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have our last few moments with the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, and we'll take some letters that we have from our listeners. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org, and of course, we'll continue on with other subjects as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan with us from Chicago and the DNC. Kristen Van Genhoven is here, Judy Patrick and Sienna Freeman Tolbert. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. So let's get to some of the mail that we have just from this morning. David writes to us and says, yes, it's fair to ask how Kamala would govern, but she'd need to become a completely different person to be as wretched as Trump has been telling us he'd be. And, of course, the Supreme Court would back much of his hardness. He's a compulsive liar, a bully, and a ghoul, and his compulsion to violate norms is as disturbing as his scandalous policy choices. That from David. We go to John. It was going to be a close race before the convention. Now with all the energy and messaging coming out of the convention, how long are we going to hear it's still a close race when she's running against a convicted felon without a policy other than Project 2025? Well, that gets into what we were talking about earlier, is you can't take it for granted, obviously.
Right. Joe Biden was running against the same guy, and he was underwater with him. We will watch the polls. As much as I hate poll watching and talking about the race that way, I think the Democrats are right to say this is a close race, especially in the battleground states.
And we've learned a lesson from 2016. We're not going to get comfortable and rely on the polls like we did in 2016. We have to stay vigilant.
I think you're right. I don't think I'll ever be comfortable again after 2016. We go to, let's see, Russell. As far as major issues that have been missing at the convention, reforming the Supreme Court should be top of mind. All the great things the Harris administration plans to do for our country may very well hit a brick wall unless we can do something about our illegitimate, corrupt, and extreme Supreme Court. Then we go to this letter from James. Oprah was great last night, and so was former President Clinton. How about that one-liner, though, about breaking up? Who said that?
wasn't a terrific. Did he actually use the term bro? I don't know what this is.
Is he talking about? He's talking about. Gosh, his name's not coming. Hakeem Jeffries talking about the. Calling Trump the bad ex-boyfriend, I think.
Yeah.
That won't go away.
That was a great moment. The ex-boyfriend who won't go away.
Hey, as long as we're talking about great moments, can we talk about Gus?
Oh my gosh, heart-wrenching.
Yeah. Tim Walz's son, who,
yes.
When his father was up on stage and talking about how much he loved his family, Gus, the, I think, 17 or 18-year-old son, gets up and he is just in tears and clapping. And I think he overshadowed Oprah because people, I've watched it 4 or 5 times. I probably will watch it 100 more times because that was a genuine moment that I think touched. It had to even trunk. Touched MAGA people. I mean, it was just a wonderful moment, and it will be something.
I don't think you can ever overshadow Oprah.
I think so.
My daughter didn't even know who Oprah was. So
really,
she had no idea.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Well, you know, and here it begins.
Yeah,
yeah. I was thrilled about seeing Sheila E. You know, who I'm sure my son doesn't even know who she is, but, you know, he liked Lil Jon. So I do think that, though, that speaks to how this convention is really spanning generations and doing a great job of including everyone. So that's been fun. I can't wait to see what we are in store for tonight.
Jade says, enough of the fluff and zingers, please. Policy is what counts. Arms embargo on Israel. Let the delegates speak about Palestinian genocide. Lead pipes, housing, education, healthcare, tax the rich, police reform, and so much more.
Yeah, Mayor, what is it like, the atmosphere there with the uncommitted protesters outside and what's happening inside? Like, what's the atmosphere? What does it feel like there with that issue?
Yeah, the protesters are very small in number. And look, I think that we all want to see an end to the war in Israel. We want to see aid flow into Gaza. We want to ensure that the Palestinian people do not continue to suffer. We want to see the hostages released and brought home. So, you know, it's not that Democrats don't care about these issues. We care deeply about these issues. And, you know, we need to have adult leadership in the room continuing to press on these issues. But, you know, I walked in last night. I've taken the bus a couple of nights and not seen any of the protesters. Last night, the entrance that I used, there were a handful of protesters there. But, you know, people are, again, we you know, we're not ignoring this issue. It's really complicated and complex, and it's horrific seeing what's happening in Gaza. And, you know, seeing and hearing from the families of people who are still being held hostage by Hamas. So, you know, I think that we have a lot of commonality with respect to these issues. It's just being able to find the solutions is not as straightforward and as simple as some would hope and want it to be.
So when we talk about complexity and we talk about transportation options, the convention will be over tonight, and you'll hear this incredible speech, and then you come home. What do you make of the airport authority story?
I try to mind my own business.
But can you? I mean, is that possible to do? I mean, in the sense of it's Albany's airport, for goodness sakes. I mean, obviously, when it was announced that we were going to be getting a new airport and the infrastructure money was there, I mean, you were there with all of your colleagues. I mean, this is a city story, and I don't know. I mean, it would seem to me it would be hard for you to mind your own business.
Well, look, I can say this. I think that Phil Calderon has done an outstanding job. You know, when you can do a $200+ million expansion with other people's money, as we say, having that be grant funded and not have to bond for that and then be concerned about, you know, a huge debt service, that's just masterful work. And he's done an outstanding job. You know, the county executive has now said that he's not going to seek the job. And wouldn't take it. So I don't know what went on behind closed doors. I don't know, you know, any of the ins and outs of that. I think it's going to be really important that we get another outstanding leader to lead the airport, because, again, it's doing quite well. You know, my understanding is that it is going to be expanding even more flights. And all of that is positive, and the airport is critically important to economic development in the entire region.
Mayor Kathy Sheehan, I thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. I hope you have very safe travels. I hope you enjoy the party tonight, and I believe you are joining us in studio for an ultimate wrap-up on Monday, so we look forward to that as well.
I look forward to it, too. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much. We will be back with more right after this.
Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find, reaching for something in the day.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Thanks to the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, for joining us this morning and taking time out of her schedule from the Democratic National Convention. And again, she will be with us on Monday as well. We welcome in studio Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Judy Patrick, and Kristen Van Genhoven, and we thank all of them for taking the time out as well. We welcome you to join in on the conversation, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I know this is like the most talk showy question that I'm going to ask, and I try not to do these, but because they're so cliched. But I think in this case, it's probably warranted. But the nominee for the Democrats for president of the United States, the current Vice President Kamala Harris, will be speaking tonight. Tonight is her night, and she'll be accepting the nomination. What would you like? What do you think you'll hear? What do you hope you'll hear from her?
Well, I hope I hear it earlier than I have.
Earlier than the Biden time?
Earlier than Biden and earlier than Tim Walz. Walz had a great speech, but I wish it was an hour earlier. I counted there were 36 speakers last night. 36. Cut some people off. I know you want to give everybody their moment in the sun, but I heard one of the Harris campaign communication officials talking this morning, saying that the goal is to get her on the stage 10 Central Time, 11. I can live with that. And to those who will remind us that there's a different time zones, I'm telling you, there are key swing states in the Eastern time zone, being North Carolina and Pennsylvania, and even Georgia. So let's have it earlier. She's got some hard acts to follow. I mean, we're building and building, and I almost worry that things have gone so well that it's going to be hard for her to really make the kind of impact that's going to supersede Oprah, that's going to supersede Tim Walz. I mean, this is a tough room, and the expectations are so super high.
I expect that I will be crying tonight. I expect that there will be tears from me, no matter what she says, because the idea that she's the nominee, which I can be very candid and honest that it was something I was not even expecting. When Biden tapped her to be the nominee, I was shocked. I was afraid of what that would look like. I was not hopeful about how the American people would respond. And I've been overwhelmed with joy seeing the response to Vice President Kamala Harris's nomination. So no matter what she says, she can stand there in a suit and just wave. I will probably be tearing up because the moment means so much, not just because she is Black and a woman and Asian American, but because she is qualified and she's going to make an excellent president. And so I'm just so excited. So she can stand there and wave. Maybe Beyonce can come out and sing at the same time. that would take me over the edge.
I think that might be the surprise.
If she comes out and sings Freedom while she's walking out, I could be like, calmly just say, hello. And we'll be like, yes, every day.
The Beyonce question looms large.
It looms large. I mean, in the ideal world, Taylor will step out from the side as well.
I think they got to hold Taylor's endorsement for a little longer.
Yeah, we'll hold it. We'll hold it. But
got to keep that in their back pocket.
I think this is the moment. And I think, I would love to hear her get out there and speak about policy and what have you. You know, me, I'm an immigration head, so I want to hear about that. But just her being there after this week of energy, it's enough for me.
You know, yeah. This is going to be what I refer to as Shaggy question, but we were remembering Alice Green yesterday, and we played an interview that I did with her a few years back, and we were talking about the difference between not only was she obviously one of the foremost activists in our area and in the nation, but was a civil rights activist, but she was dealing with racism and sexism. And she was talking about, you know, first, I'm an African-American woman, but I am a woman and I'm still dealing with sexism. And I'm just interested from your perspective of, I mean, obviously that goes together. But to see we've had a woman on the ticket, Hillary Clinton and yes, Geraldine Ferraro, of course, and then when Kamala went on as vice president, but to have a woman of color as the lead on a major party ticket, and a ticket right now that seems to be doing okay, what does that mean?
I always tell my husband, I said, if she wins this election, watch out. Because I'm going to take the head of every table I'm sitting at. Excuse me, move to the side. We're here now. move. The confidence that comes back.
I mean,
it's we joke about it, but I'm never sitting on the side of a table again. I'm going to sit only at the top of the table in the front. Yeah. Here I am. I joke about it, but it is a sense of you can do anything you want. You can be anything you want to be. Having my daughter sitting there, I mean, and watching that and knowing that it is, we mean what we say, and this is what that's the feeling you felt when President Obama was elected, right? You remember, you were like, oh my, everyone was shocked. Tears were coming down because we never thought we would come to this. I mean, the Civil Rights Act was in the 1960s, right? You know what I'm saying? We can't even fathom this. This is unfathomable what's happening right now. This that a black woman who is, you know, it's so hard to be a woman. It's so hard to be a woman. And it's also hard to have that, to also be a person of color and a woman. I mean, it's just, it's quite the, I don't want to call it a burden, it's an honor, but it is difficult.
And that's why, if I can add I think because a person of color who is a woman who has made their way to be the vice president of the United States, I think she is perfectly positioned to hit it out of the park tonight because she had to overcome so much to get to that position, right? It's like, that's the person I want in my corner because I know that you have had to overcome so many things in your life to get to this point where you can, and for her to still be what they're calling a joyful warrior, to not be a warrior, to be a joyful warrior.
Amazing.
That is amazing. So I think what we've heard over the past few days is that this woman is ready for it. I mean, in my experience, every person who comes from these communities that we have been overlooking for far too long are so prepared for these moments because they have been facing these barriers for so long that they are the people that I want in my corner because I'm like, you have had to overcome some stuff.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said.
What does it say to you that the message that has, I don't want to make it sound like it. A, it's a message, and B, that it's anything new, but the Trump, I don't even know what it's called. I was going to say strategy. I don't know. That word doesn't seem to fit. But anyway, the plan we're going to focus in on the issues, and then of course that dies in about 4 seconds, and then he's in on the name and the laugh and going after where she's from and what we know and what we don't know and just immediately reverting back to. Just these tropes, and I ask the question because we don't know, and I'm not pretending to know, and I'm not pretending to say that this is over by any stretch of the imagination. But as of this moment, and the polls that are taken, it does not seem to be working the way it did 4 years ago, 8 years ago.
I mean, it's beautiful how she's dealing with it, and she's showing us how we should deal with it. Is that been here before. I've played this game with these kind of guys before. I know what this looks like. And it's weird. And it's weird that you're doing this when we should be talking on a more elevated level than just about, you know, where I'm from or whether or not I'm really Black. And I think everyone's giving it the kind of flippance that they should. You know, Michelle Obama did it. Like, did he know that he's going for a Black job? Like, I mean, it's just ridiculous. And that's how she's treating it, because she's saying, I've been here before. I've done this. I was a prosecutor. How do you think I got there? I was an attorney general. How do you think I got there? I've dealt with these kind of people. And then, as always, you have your allies with you the whole time, right? And you have them boistering you and saying that you are worthy. It's so important that those voices are saying she is worthy, because, you know, you hear these DEI attacks.
Right.
And that's the DEI attack, right? That's what people want to say, that you're there just because you are Black. You're there just because you're a woman.
I mean, that took an hour from her being announced by the president as his pick before it was labeled a DEI hire.
Which is wrong on so many levels, but nevertheless. But that was why it was so important that we spent all week with all those speakers saying how qualified she is, how worthy she is, because that's how they choose to pinpoint her. As someone that sits in a room with majority white people in their, you know, in their profession, you feel that. Sometimes you feel like people are looking at you and they say,
"She's talking about us."
Yes. No. But I mean, sometimes you feel like people feel like you're there just because of the color of your skin. Mm-hmm. And that is something that you constantly work to prove that you're not. You're constantly trying to prove that you're there because of your expertise and your, you know, educational background and your, you know. And so I feel like her response is there. And I feel like when you have your group, your allies there to speak to that, to your expertise and the fact that you're not there just because you just happen to be. I just happen to be a Black woman. I just happen to be a woman of color. But I'm also very, you know, qualified for this position. I think it's so important, so poignant. And that's why I thought it was so important that we have all these people speaking power into her this week.
And also the fact that, like, what needs to be happening and what we're starting to see in the Democratic Party, and they're modeling it for us, is that she doesn't have to spend any time trying to show us that she's worthy for this. She shouldn't be spending any time. Everyone around her is doing that, and she just has to do what she does, right? Because that is not a position that you should ever be in, any person should ever be in, who has to be like, I have to constantly prove this. That is this emotional burden for far too long that people have been carrying, and we have to be the ones that don't experience that, that take it away, that are like, that's why that first phone call was like, everybody knew exactly what was going to be happening within an hour of it. You know, we all know, we've seen it happening. That's, I do like the deflation tactic of just like, yeah, this is not a surprise. I remember being at a conference when Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed. White women were freaking out, who were especially older white women, crying. They couldn't believe it happened. All the people who were not older white women or people who have really had to go through some crap in their life, they're like, this is not a surprise. Like, just keep going, man. Like, just keep moving forward. Like, this stuff's going to keep happening. You got to keep. That's what I thought it was brilliant that Michelle Obama said, the product of the affirmative action of generational wealth. That was one of those takeaways. Mm-hmm. There were so many takeaways from what they're saying. But that's why I don't think tonight she's going to. She's just going to be in the the person that she is, that is ready for this job. And she's not only going to show us that she's going to be doing it with joy, which is her version of the dignity and grace that Joe Biden has been able to maintain, you know, of being a genuinely kind person after 50 years in politics. She's been able to maintain a sense of joy through everything she's had to go through. But she's also going to show us what they're, you know, touting and the strategy they're choosing of her warrior self, of how she is going to be able to deal and everything that she has done. And so I have complete faith that she's going to knock it out of the park, and that she is completely ready for this moment because of everything her life has led her to this. And our world, our life over the past 12 years has led us to this and beyond, not even 12 years, generations has led us to this moment.
I can't say this enough, that like I know that this can change on a dime, because it always can change on a dime. But as of right now, I think when Hillary Clinton in her speech said, "We have him on the run now," it seems like it's the first time in a really long time that he has appeared to have been, quote, on the run.
But don't overlook his ability
to tap
into the disgruntled young white males. I think the Harris campaign has done a great job of locking in the base and energizing the base. I think she still has to do some work to make sure she retains the support of those older Biden supporters that may be racist or sexist.
And the 74 million people that vote Republican, right? It's like, it's that fear you were talking about of like, when people are really in the voting booth, are they going to be able to tick that box for a woman and a woman of color? Like, are they really going to be able to dig in there and do that? And I think we can't spend, we can think, we got to just do it, right? We have to just be like, yeah. We have to believe that there are more of those people now that are going to be able to do that than the people that don't.
But when you talk about the young white male voter, I was thinking about that based on like Trump's actions and what's been going on. So what I look at is, you know, Joe Rogan, which is one of the largest podcasts out there. He doesn't necessarily endorse Trump. He was going, you know, he was going for Kennedy. And so you wonder where all those all those people will go. But also in the same vein, Trump just had a good interview with, I think, Theo Von.
Is that his name?
Yeah, comedian.
Comedian.
Past Real World. I mean, that's how I know him. But he had a really good interview, and he really hit that. And his main audience is young white males. So you just wonder, when you talk about the white male contingency, where will they go? That's a big gray area. When you have Rogan, who's not necessarily a Trump supporter, but, you know, he's also trying to hit that.
Well, especially when we're hearing that Robert Kennedy might drop out and it might be endorsing Trump, and like that's going to be a whole thing. So we'll have to see.
I just like the reporting that the RFK campaign kept on trying to reach the Harris campaign, and they just didn't even take his calls.
Candidate for hire.
Yeah, they're just like, nah, we're good. Thank you. So let's talk about that for a second. We have heard, we did touch on the story yesterday, but RFK Jr. has indicated that probably tomorrow he will announce in Phoenix that he is leaving the race. It just so happens that President Trump will also be in Arizona tomorrow. So the question is, A, we assume that he will leave the race, as has been reported and as indicated, by no less than his vice presidential candidate, so his running mate. So that's one. And then two, as you indicated, that most likely he will endorse Donald Trump. I was playing, and I don't know how, I mean, I don't, as accurate as polls are, but I was playing with the New York Times website last night, and you can take the Trump number, you can take the RFK numbers out and see what difference that makes, put them in, you can put them into Biden, you can put them into Trump, you can play with it to see how that goes. It doesn't seem like it really makes any difference, quite frankly. I mean, he was polling at about 4%. And it so I don't know what that will do.
I think people think it varies from state, from battleground state to battleground state.
Right.
And it depends on where, like, will the anti-vax people go to Trump? What kinds of issues? Or are RFK supporters just because they don't like Trump and Biden? And if he's out, are they going to go to one of the other third party candidates? I don't think they're necessarily going to follow him to Trump, but I guess we'll see. He seems to have be doing this so his name will actually be off the ballot in key states, because even if he drops out, if his name's still on the ballot, that can influence the numbers, because not everybody pays attention. I think it's crucial that his name is off the ballot for it to really make a difference.
I mean, I don't, you know, I said earlier, I think it just matters what battlegrounds say. I agree with you. I was listening to some reporting, and they were saying they don't know if he's necessarily 100% endorsing Trump because his wife may not be in support of that. So I thought it was interesting.
Cheryl Hines.
Yeah, Cheryl from Curb. That's how I know her. I'm sorry.
Cheryl Hines from Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yes. So I was reading that reporting closely. I just don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how big of an impact it's going to have. I'm, you know, obviously watching Michigan a lot for me, and what the uncommitted voters are thinking and what they're going to do there, because that's a huge issue for the Democrats. But
well, when you think about these battleground states and the, you know, level of margin being so tight, that does have to give the Democrats pause. You know, if he is going to endorse Trump and he does have these voters where they could go in so many different places based on the anti-vax or the, you know, the different beliefs that they have, it could be something that they need to dig into and drill down a little bit more, because all those battleground states come down to 10,000 votes, you know, 15,000 votes, 12,000 votes. I mean, those are tiny numbers. So that's given me pause about that. And because, yeah, at the big umbrella, taking it out, I was curious about that, too. I'm like, here's a guy who started as a Democrat, became an independent. Now he's going to endorse a Republican. Like, how seriously can you take this person? Which has been a big question along the way. But they do have followers. You know, it's like every third party candidate has followers. And where are they going to go when some of these races come down really to the wire? Like we keep hearing at the DNC, every single vote is really going to matter, especially in those battleground states. I mean, that's the thing for me as a Canadian that is like continual, and I'm sure for so many Americans, which I am also, it's very difficult to really come to terms and find any sort of acceptance with the fact that actually this election is decided by, what is it, you know, 100,000 people in six states. I mean, that's so hard. It's such a hard pill to swallow.
Thanks for reminding us, Cameron.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking forward to RFK Jr. being inconsequential. I'm tired about reading about him. I'm tired about listening to him. I'm waiting for the day when he calls up and wants to be interviewed and the media says, no, not interested.
That's how we all feel about the person who leads the other big party.
But I mean, isn't that sort of what happened? I mean, it went downhill quick. And the other thing too is that it, to me, any momentum that he had was because he wasn't Trump and he wasn't Biden.
And he had the last name Kennedy.
And he had the last name Kennedy, and then the family came out against him. And then you say, okay, so he's not Biden, he's not Trump, and then Biden goes away, and people are like, oh, all right, well, we don't really need okay, so that's not. And
then there's the bear, and then
right,
it spiraled.
And you can't,
I'm waiting for that Netflix documentary.
There are so many good Netflix documentaries.
Yeah, there really are. I'm trying to figure that one out. Just my goodness. I listened to him tell that story again on that podcast. It's just truly bizarre.
You went to dinner, right?
And why was Roseanne Barr there? Like, what's the relationship?
It was her show, I think.
Oh.
Yeah.
These talk shows that Sienna's daughter also doesn't know exist.
No idea.
Doesn't know who Oprah is. Doesn't know
what
talk shows
are. You know.
What are talk shows?
Oh.
I mean, not, definitely know who, if you don't know who Roseanne is, you'll be all right. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll finish up with this wonderful group. We have letters, we have new topics, and all of that good stuff. We'll take a break. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after news from the BBC. Natasha Bedingfield and Pocketful of Sunshine and An Evening with Darlene Love and Natasha Bedingfield will be taking place as part of a very special benefit event for Berkshire Theater Group and Barrington Stage Company at the Colonial in Pittsfield on Thursday, August 29th. You can find out more by going to barringtonstageco.org or berkshiretheatergroup.org, and you can see the playlist posted on our website, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable, and we welcome you. All right, let's go to, let's see, I thought I had some letters here I wanted to get to. As you speak, I'm thinking about Pete Buttigieg's speech last night in which he spoke about his own personal struggle. He said, and I wish I could quote it exactly, that in his own lifetime, the dreams of a gay teenager went from the impossible to possible to reality and is now normal, very inspiring. Then Charles, Tim Walz attained the rank of E9 in the military. Only 1% of enlisted personnel achieve this position, one of deep leadership and high trust. He has the strong aura of someone ready to take charge. The nation is fortunate to have someone with such a strong character as Vice President of the United States.
I was going to say, we were talking about the young white males and how do we reach get them under the Democratic tent. And I was just saying Coach Walz does a good job. That idea of him being a coach, a football coach, getting that ESPN kind of, you know, feel. And I think he does a great job of reaching out and really appealing to that constituency. I think that's what he's one of his primary purposes is, and I think he's doing a very good job of it.
Absolutely. All right, let's go to other topics. We'll obviously go into this in major detail with Aaron Pasitti tomorrow on the program, but the U.S. added 818,000 fewer jobs than reported earlier. So, of course, we'll talk about that also just the question marks about why that wasn't reported correctly, which is in of itself interesting. But the U.S. economy added far fewer jobs in 2023 and early 2024 than previously reported, a sign that cracks in the labor market are more severe and began forming earlier than initially believed. On Wednesday, the Labor Department said monthly payroll figures overstated job growth by roughly 818,000 jobs in 12 months that ended in March. That suggests employers added about 174,000 jobs per month during that period, down from the previously reported pace of 242,000 jobs, a downward revision of about 28%. I'm pretty sure that if I had written, correct me if I'm wrong here, Judy, but if I had written that sentence in my journalism class, they would have said too many numbers too early.
Too many, yes. Very, very. It's hard to write about business. I'll give you that, or I'll give the writer that. But they should be experts at it at this point.
The revisions, which are preliminary, are part of an annual process in which monthly estimates based on surveys are reconciled with more accurate but less timely records from state employment offices. The new figures, once they're made final, will be incorporated into official government employment statistics early next year. The updated numbers are the latest sign of vulnerability in the job market, which until recently had appeared rock solid despite months of high interest rates and economists' warnings of an impending recession. Most recent data, which wasn't affected by the revisions,
suggests job growth slowed further in the spring and summer, and the unemployment rate, though still relatively low at 4.3%, has been gradually rising. What happened?
You know, updates are typical. They always update the figure after a year after they get the real numbers in. But the extent of this update was more dramatic than anticipated. And I think that's shaking some confidence out there. And the big thing was whether or not Jerome Powell and the Federal Reserve, what they're going to do with interest rates in September. I think everybody was, you know, we were sitting fat and happy and waiting for those interest rates to start coming down. And that's possible still. But what's happening with wage growth, what's happening with unemployment still remains a key issue. And it will be, as we talk about, a political issue as well. So I'm surprised because it seems to me like there's a lot of job openings out there. It seems like I don't know anybody who's looking for a job who can't find a job. But the numbers don't lie.
It'll be really interesting to hear Aaron's expertise weigh in on this tomorrow, because as I was listening to it, I thought, well, obviously the Republicans are going to jump on this. You know, this is a big deal. The economy and immigration are these two big issues that people are thinking about. So this is going to be something that gives them a lot of fodder. We also, you know, when I was digging into it a little bit more, you're hearing a lot of different things from different economists. So I will be really curious to hear Aaron's share his perspective on kind of how to parse all of that out, because we're hearing a lot of different things. Some people, this is a big deal. Some people, this is not a big deal. We're also hearing a lot about how to hold, I think the article shared, you know, all of the variables that we have to keep in mind that give us context and perspective on these numbers. To Judy's point, we always hear the first numbers and then we always hear the second numbers. If you look at it over the past 5 years, there's always a discrepancy. It maybe hasn't been this large in a while, but we also haven't ever been recovering from a pandemic, you know, and I think people forget how much that is still affecting the economy globally and also nationally. They're also talking about how replies to the initial survey are falling, how we have to think about businesses that open or close or the businesses that don't give data. There are a lot of assumptions that become a little less reliable in these periods of what the article says, rapid changes in the labor market. So it's easy to look at a headline and go, ah, you know, and the Republicans are going to be able to jump on that. But when you really parse it out and look at all of the different perspectives influencing why the numbers are changing, not all of them have to do with what's actually happening on the ground. Some of them have to do with how the data is collected. You know, so I think we're not good at kind of keeping all those different variables in mind when we're looking at numbers. We just, you know, we have these short attention spans. We take in the number. We think, oh, that's it. This is terrible. But I would like to know from Aaron if he agrees with what it says in the article. The big picture remains relatively unchanged. Job growth is slowing, but it's not collapsing. The unemployment rate is rising, but layoffs are low. Like, that's the big picture. It's the big picture we've been having. It's what the Federal Reserve has been working really hard to mitigate with all the interest rate stuff. That big picture hasn't changed. So as more op-eds and more economists weigh in on this, I'll be very curious as it continues to get parsed out, like, how big of a deal is this, especially when we put it in the context of the fact that we're still recovering from this global pandemic?
I think, the problem is, and I guess they need to take all those factors into account. But the problem is that it kind of coincides with what the feeling is in the country, right? The feeling is that the economy is bad. That's the talking point. That's what it feels like. Things cost more. So just, you know, that's the tangible thing. And so I think the Harris campaign needs to get on top of this and how they're going to message this and how they're going to, you know, they've been trying. I think that's one of the hardest thing for them. The message is that the economy's not bad. We've been doing well under Biden. And I think with this article coming out, it kind of slaps that in the face. And it's all about the response, because that's exactly what people are feeling. When I read the article, I said, this is what people are going to say. This is exactly what we thought. You know, we were right. And I'm really curious to see how the messaging happens around this, because there has to be really tight messaging, because I think that is the Harris campaign's weakest spot is the economy and how people are feeling about how much things cost in these last few years. And it's hard to talk about those variables in a way that's succinct and that sinks in when you're paying, you know, astronomical amounts for eggs and milk and the basics of life. So We'll just have to see.
Yeah, did we have that soft landing? I haven't been keeping track. We didn't go into a recession, but there was always this talk that we were going to have a soft landing. And I thought that somebody had declared not that long ago, yep, we did the soft landing. When do we know for sure that we've landed softly? And when can we go on with our economic life?
Nothing seems soft.
No. Everybody's waiting for Jerome Powell to come on high to share it, and he's holding those cards pretty close to his chest.
Let's go to letters. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I supported Kamala Harris before I supported Joe Biden in 2020. I contributed to her campaign and was disappointed that her candidacy did not succeed. When Biden chose her for his vice president, I made a contribution to their campaign and continue to do so for the campaign season. When Biden was going through the VP vetting process, he announced quite openly that his pick would be a woman. He further stated that the woman would be a woman of color. He narrowed it down to three candidates, Karen Bass, Keisha Lance Bottoms, and Kamala Harris. I thought Stacey Abrams was also in that group, but I could be wrong. Mm. I was thrilled that he chose Harris. Let's be honest, she was a DEI pick. As long as we're being honest, not picking, Josh Shapiro was based on DEI. I also take issue with the female speaker who, well, that's our whole group this morning, but okay. I also take issue with the female speaker who expressed how hard it is to be a woman. I long for the day when all women recognize the power they have if they care to use it. That said, I support the Harris-Walz ticket in November. That is from Lynn.
Well, I'm very glad that Lynn is supporting the Harris-Walz ticket. And I think maybe you're talking about a couple of things that I shared as well. You know, I'm teaching a class where, you know, we're learning so much about the white lash that's happening right now, the backlash against DEI. And you know what? The words don't matter. You call it what you want. The reality is do we believe that our world is better off when we have multiple perspectives sitting at the table? Do we believe that our world is better off when anybody with whatever identity they have, whatever abilities they have, whatever class they come from or gender they are, all of those things, that they have the opportunity that they need to try to reach the potential that they can have in their life? So if the world wants to phrase it as DEI backlash, you know, it's like, what are the values that are behind that? And do we believe in those? Can we stand up for those? So what I'm learning in the class that I'm taking is like, call it what you like. If we want to have a chapter right now where it's DEI backlash, let's go back to the values and let's see if that's what we stand for. We've also learned that, like, we do have to conscientiously make our rooms look different. So sometimes you are going to make specific choices, as WAMC has done, to like make sure that the people around the panel look different, bring different perspectives in order for the conversation to be more robust, more rich, full of deeper perspectives, provide many more points for all of us to reflect on as we continue to try to evolve and grow as human beings and become the country that our founders thought maybe we could be. And so I think that sometimes if people are saying, you know, what did people say when they said, oh, Kamala Harris has to get a white guy as her running mate. Is that a DEI pick? Is he a DEI pick? You know, because he had to be a white guy. So I think we all just need to question ourselves, like, what are the values behind the labels that we're giving things? And what is it that we can get behind? And so that's, I guess, how I would respond to that particular panel writer, and I don't know if anybody else wants to add anything.
Well, I would let anybody add anything, but we're out of time.
Aww.
So my apologies. So you're off the hook. But thank you. But you know, store it up, and you can give it to us later on. That'd be fine. My thanks to everyone for being with us again. Thanks to Kathy Sheehan, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Judy Patrick, Kristen Van Genhoven. You're all wonderful. We'll be back right after this.